from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's not as though we've never had government shutdowns over the federal budget before. In fact, since 1976, it's happened 17 times, now 18. But the divisions behind the shutdown this time, the first time in a long time, seem different, wider, more intractable, dangerous. What is it about our politics these days that is driving our government off the rails? This hour on Point, paralysis in Washington and what's going on with our democracy. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see? What is happening and why? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got a good panel lined up for you today. We're going to start in Washington with Ron Fournier. He's editorial director of the National Journal. His article out today is headlined, "The Beginning of the End for Washington." Subhead, "The Impasse." This impasse could be the breaking point for a political system that has gone from dysfunctional to non-functioning. Ron Fournier, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
How do you explain it? What is happening here?
Well, our government is going off the rails. We have one party that is holding the functioning of our government and potentially the full faith and credit of our economy at hostage to relitigate a bill that they don't like. And it's one of those cases where the public is not going to be happy with either side, even a side, in this case, the Democrats, that might be able to argue they're less at fault. Now, the bottom line is everyone owns this problem. And it's depressing.
But it sounds like you're taking the White House Harry Reid view. This is the Republicans' fault. It's all their fault. It's their fault. And it's their fault.
I do think that the Republicans are more at fault, but and I'll explain why if you want. But frankly, I don't think the American public really cares who's more at fault. They want both sides to find a way out of this. And I think the president certainly and his party certainly has some blame here. But you do have to, if you look at it fairly and if you really want to assess blame, you do have to look at the fact that we're arguing over not over a year's long worth of spending. We're talking about a continuing resolution, and we have a party that is closing down the government because he wants the president to do something that we know he won't do. As a matter of fact, he can't do. Politically, he could never get away with it. And it just wouldn't be a good precedent. What happens if there is a Republican president 4 years from now who gets through, let's say, a huge tax increase that's really important to him and his party, and the Democrats coming up to the next debt ceiling fight says, you know what? I know it passed and we didn't have enough votes, but you have to repeal it or we're going to shut down the government.
A Republican is going to fight for a huge tax increase. Do you see that coming? You mean decrease?
I'm sorry. Thank you very much. Okay. A tax decrease. The point is you can't have a minority party hold the government hostage. And I know that is the White House talking point, but in this case, it happens to be true. Now, one thing the White House has got to do is, especially the president, he can't just sit back defensively and just say, these guys are bad guys and hope it all works out at the end. He is going to own this at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
This is his government. History is going to judge. His legacy will be tied to how well this economy is doing. And if it tanks over this, he's not going to be able to get around that.
Ron, it's the first time in a long time. It's been 17 years until 2 days since we've had a shutdown. But since 1976, there are already 17 of these. I mean, I'm looking back over this list. October 76, shutdown. 18 days. Here is 79, shutdown. 81, shutdown. 82, shutdown. On and on. It's not as though we haven't had government shutdowns before. And people didn't say in those days, until maybe the middle of the 90s, but in general, they didn't say things are coming apart. What's the difference here?
Well, because it's not in a vacuum. And for one thing, what's right around the corner here is the threat that we're going to default on our debt, which is the fact that that is even on the table just blows my mind, because that would have incredibly negative consequences for the economy and for people out there who just want their leaders to lead and not to be bickering over this. And I really think that it just feels to me that we're coming towards a tipping point when the American public is going to be more than mad as hell. They're actually going to do something about it.
I mean, people said that a few—
No, you're right. People have said this before, but we're living in a time when voters are as angry as they've been probably since the early 90s. You know, when Ross Perot managed to get 19% of the vote, even though he wasn't the most stable candidate. In addition to that anger and the frustration and people being left behind, we have a very empowered populace. Institutions that aren't functioning in our society today get blown up and get disrupted by a very empowered populace that can mobilize and make and effect change through the technology. And if they can change my industry, for example, the way they have your industry, you know, the media,
journalism.
Why is it that they have to put up with status quo in politics, which clearly isn't working? This isn't just about this last month. The government is not functioning in a sane way, and that the status quo just can't sustain itself.
What makes you think that angry or upset or fed up voters will go toward reform here? I mean, you've got Tom Harkin in Iowa talking about, you know, politics at civil war levels in this country. Maybe the anger goes toward further division, Ron.
It could, except I think that if my reading of the data, especially my reading of this generation that's coming up, these so-called millennials, they are, generally speaking, much more pragmatic, much more results-orientated, much less ideologically driven, much more tolerant, much more consensus-building. They want things to happen. They grew up in an age where you pushed a button on the computer and stuff happened. They're not going to put up with this, I don't think, with a government that is gridlocked right now. And they're always going to be that, you know, 10-15% way to the left and 10 or 15 way to the right. But the middle that is just hanging on economically, actually they're falling behind. Mm-hmm. And then seeing this childishness in Washington, they're a lot more empowered than they ever were before. So I just don't see how this sustain. I think the question should be turned on itself. How does this keep going on at a time when they're blowing up? People are able to revolutionize journalism, revolutionize retail industry, revolutionize the music industry, revolutionize.
Yeah, but you're talking about revolutionizing our system of government that has been pretty impervious to revolution.
We've had lowercase, you know, revolutions. Look what happened coming out of the Gilded Age with Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. Look what happened after the Civil War.
Yeah.
Look what happened with the founding. I mean, this is a democracy, and I just don't think we can sustain 70% of the public thinking the country's going the wrong track and the leadership of this kind of folly we have in Washington. I know it's not going to be easy, and I can't paint the road for you, but But how does this sustain itself? I ask you that.
10% approval rating for Congress, and Congress taking us, well, who knows, over the edge. We'll see where we go. Republicans saying, not our fault. Here's the House Appropriations Committee chairman. This is Harold Rogers of Kentucky saying House Republicans being reasonable.
The House is not the body that is refusing to act. We aren't the ones who are not willing to budge. We've now offered, this is the third or fourth compromise to the Senate. They simply ignore us. Throw it in the trash can.
It's that Democratic Senate, Ron Fournier, Rogers saying there.
Well, you know, what the House is asking is that the president give up, for the sake of a short-term spending bill, give up his signature achievement. And if he did it, he would be politically impotent. And he would set a precedent that a party that controls one half of one branch of government can hold the government and the other party completely hostage. I think he's, in my humble opinion, he's making promises to his base that he knows he can't keep. He knows that Obamacare is not going to go away unless Republicans win enough elections, as people like Tom Cole and Tom Coburn, very conservative of members of Congress, unless they win elections like some of the more reasonable conservatives say they have to. They're not going to overturn it this way. They know that, and they're deceiving their base, and I just find that kind of distasteful.
I want to broaden our conversation. Ron Fournier with National Journal. It's great to have you right here. We're looking at what's going on. What is behind it at bottom here? I want to bring in Nolan McCarty right now, professor of political science at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public International Affairs, co-author of Polarized America. Nolan McCarty, thanks very much for being with us. What do you see driving this deep division? And now, Ron Fournier says, going from dysfunction to non-function. What's going on, Nolan?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As Ron mentioned, this is an event that's a long time in coming. American politics has been polarizing for almost 35 years now. So year after year, we see less and less cooperation between the parties, more and more divisiveness. So to some extent, this would happen at some point is not a big surprise. I think what we see is the kind of climax of a division between the parties over the role of the federal government that really has shown itself very clearly over the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare. And this is the Republicans' sort of last attempt to try to do something to prevent it from going into effect.
What's at the heart of this standoff, though? What is driving this thing? I mean, we've seen this gap open wider and wider, and I think a lot of people are asking why?
Well, this is the new cottage industry in political science is to try to figure out the reasons for our polarization. So there are a lot of causes that people have speculated on, things like the gerrymandering of congressional districts, the role of partisan primaries in our system. But ultimately, those haven't borne very much fruit in terms of an explanation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the paralyzing division in Washington, asking what is going on with our democracy, our country, on the day of government shutdown and maybe a big default drama just around the corner, even as we look at this. Nolan McCarty is with us, professor of political science at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, co-author of Polarized America. Ron Fournier is here, editorial director of National Journal in Washington. Former Republican Congressman Charles Bass joins us in just a moment. Nolan McCarty, Ron Fournier, you know, we asked online what's fundamentally driving the logjam in Washington. We got all kinds of reactions here. Judy says gerrymandering. You say not. I want to test that with you, Nolan. Phil says Republicans. It's their damn fault. Christie says arrogance on both sides, lack of leadership on both sides. And I mean, just on and on and on. David says a bought and paid for minority of Congress run to the tune played by the Koch brothers. You know, you've got sort of every explanation under the sun here. We've got a listener who says here, Diane says, easy. It's an undereducated population who's elected scoundrels and ideologues. People are really throwing out up their hands and out their ideas here. Nolan, you say it's not gerrymandering. It's not partisan primaries, but a lot of people have looked there. Make the case that it's not those things. I mean, don't those lock in people who are committed to a very ideologically monolithic base within their district?
Sure. Well, the first argument against gerrymandering is that the U.S. Senate has polarized almost as much as the House. Now, this past week, they've looked downright reasonable, but in general, they appear to be as partisan and polarized as the House. The second main reason we don't think gerrymandering has much to do with polarization is that what we observe is that Democrats and Republicans who represent similar districts, say moderate districts that are, say, 50 went for the president, 50%, those people are as divided in their voting behavior as any others. So it's not really that Republicans are getting safe Republican districts and Democrats are getting safe, reliably safe Democratic districts. Even in those districts that are still competitive, the divisions are almost as large. So that suggests that gerrymandering isn't really a big part of the problem.
Ron Fournier, do you buy that? A year ago this last weekend, I was at a conference with Grover Norquist. He was triumphantly passing out a map of the redistricted face of the United States. A whole lot of red on there, Republican red, and very firm, and, you know, predicting that whatever happened, it was a Republican future because the lines had just been drawn that way, and there wasn't a lot of wiggle room within them. What do you say, Ron?
I agree with Nolan to the extent that to pin this all on redistricting would be a mistake. I don't think it's any one factor. I do think, though, that when we have so many members of Congress who are only worried about being far enough to the left or far enough to the right, I'm only worried about the primary elections. That does have an effect. We've had, last I looked at numbers, 45-50% decrease in the number of actual swing districts where there actually is a chance of having a competitive race in the House. That has to have an effect. But so do things like the disruption in our business, in journalism, that now has made it so much easier for the voting public to only listen to people who are self-perpetuating their existing beliefs. So does, you know, social, you know, non-political social trends like the sorting that's going on, where people are literally moving around people who are much like themselves. And so, you know, redistricting, I think to Nolan's point, would only have a an effect on the margins. You know, part of it is cultural. We are a less or a more coarse culture and a less civil culture than we were a generation or two ago. So I don't think there's a silver bullet, but I also don't think there are any of these obstacles are any bigger than some that we've faced in other inflection points in our nation's history. And I think that's what we're at now. I think we're at a time of almost unprecedented time. We go through big inflection points like this, you know, maybe every 80 years or so.
Yeah.
And out of it will come some reform and some changes and hopefully a better system, because the institutions we have now are not working, and we either have to rebuild them or they're going to fall upon themselves.
Wow. These are stakes. Ron Fournier and Nolan McCarty, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Peterborough, New Hampshire, Charles Bass. He's president and CEO of Republican Main Street Partnership from 07 to 2010, was a congressman from New Hampshire's 2nd District from 95 to 07, and again from 2011 to 2013. His father also served as a New Hampshire congressman in the 1950s and 60s. He's contemplating running for the U.S. Senate in 2014. Charles Bass, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
What is going on here? You spent a lot of time in Congress. You must be watching this and wondering yourself, how do you read what's happening?
Well, I used to worry a lot about this kind of thing going all the way back to 1980 when I first ran for Congress. And I went to visit then former Senator Norris Cotton. And I told him, this is when Carter was president, mm-hmm. that basically everything was going wrong. There was too much partisanship. We couldn't get things done. Billy Carter was taking over the White House and so forth. And Senator Cotton said, you know, and I can't remember the rhyme perfectly, but he said, you know, young man, let me just tell you this. He said, my grandpa in his House of Logs said the world was going to the dogs. And his grandpa in the Flemish bogs said the world is going to the dogs. And then he said something like, I can only something, something but state those dogs sure have had a damn long wait.
I mean, that's a lovely piece of doggerel, but do you believe it, that this is just like every other day and age and no problem, Americans? Turn your TVs on and everything's fine?
Tom, what's driving this debate is the health care issue. When President George Bush proposed, quote-unquote, privatizing Social Security, the Democrats went off into orbit somewhere between Uranus and Pluto. Now, with President Obama as president, he has proposed national health care, basically. That's what the individual mandate represents. And that is the reason, the substantive reason, why a group of Republicans, which are definitely a minority of Congress, are willing to do anything they possibly can, because they feel that if this law is completely implemented, every American, from the day they are born, will be beholden onto the federal government for some sort of sustenance, and that's antithetical for them. Whether or not this is the right format, I think it's a terrible idea to hold up government and the debt ceiling, both of them, over the health care law. We've heard the debates on both sides. However, both the Democrats and the Republicans appear to define victory as a good battle rather than an actual solution. And that's the tragedy of the situation we are today. Mitch McConnell is in a tough primary. John Boehner has 150 or 160 members of his 230-some-odd delegation who are in a separate group from the Republicans, the Republican Study Committee. And as Speaker, he is continuously threatened. His speakership is threatened by this, and he has very little latitude. Now, when President Obama says there's a faction of one party, I would only point out that these votes in the House have been straight party line votes, and all the swing district or moderate Republicans have voted with the Speaker, most of them, I guess. So, you know, all of your prior speakers have been very articulate. about the situation we find ourselves in now. And ultimately, the solution, as someone said a minute or two ago, is going to have to come from outrage at the voter level. And they're going to have to stamp their foot and say, enough is enough.
But burn the house down over this? I mean, you know, this is essentially modeled on the plan that Mitt Romney, Republicans' own candidate for president, implemented in Massachusetts. And now when it goes national, and it had broader support than Mitt Romney, as you know, Charles Bass, in Republican think tank circles, now here it is national. You say national health care, okay, right. But it's all through private health companies. I mean, is this a big enough cause to sort of, you know, burn the village to save it over?
Well, as I said a minute ago, and again, I don't defend the tactics. I'm just talking about the substance of the issue.
Yeah.
Those individuals that are willing basically to burn down the house believe that the concept of an individual mandate is tantamount to the federal government having some control over the livelihood or life of every, the sustainability of life of every single citizen in the country. That's how they look at it. Whether you agree with it or not is not of consequence here. I disagree with the tactic. I think that this issue is over. My view would be, again, I'm a little different from the rank and file Republican, that this law is unimplementable as it is as passed, and if the Republicans are savvy and smart, they'll wait for the White House to come to the Congress with corrective measures for the legislation, which I don't think they can implement. And at that point, you can have a legitimate negotiation to change the law so that the president gets something and the Republicans get something. But this is doomed to failure right now, and the government should not have shut down. And this debate over health care should be saved for another day.
In proper order, maybe. Nolan McCarty, you say it's not gerrymandering, it's not partisan primaries. Charles Bass says, well, look at the issue itself, health care. I mean, that clearly is what has the Republicans up in arms here and Democrats digging in to save it. What is this issue representative of? You hear Charles Bass's interpretation, Nolan. Where do you see the root of this division we're looking at?
I think Congressman Bass is exactly correct. I mean, it's an ideological division that's taken root in the U.S. over the past 30 years, where, you know, the United States has been through some challenging economic times since the 1970s. Economic growth has been very unequal. Increase in inequality, increase in income insecurity. And so many Americans look for different solutions to those problems. Those on the right think that government is a big part of the problem and doesn't look to the government to solve them. People on the left look to the government to enhance and patch the safety net. And it's just the division over how we should approach these big fundamental American problems that's the real source, I think, of our polarization. So something like health care really crystallizes those divisions over turning to the government for the solution versus continued reliance on the private sector.
There used to be a bigger what people come to call the mushy middle in politics, where you could make compromises and get deals done. That's gone away. Are you saying that American inequality, in part, has driven out that mushy middle, where, you know, the sort of making of the sausage could be done, compromises, deals, negotiation?
Yeah, I think that the inequality has crystallized ideological differences, and it's made taking ideological principles much more seriously in Congress than before. One of the things that's happened that I think is important, Ron mentioned before, changes in the media environment and so forth, is really nationalized politics in a way. In the old days, the mushy middle made deals by pursuing bipartisan pork barrel projects. They got together, traded horses, traded projects, in the end could reach the solutions, because what was important was bringing home pork to the district. That sort of pork barrel-based politics has really been replaced by much more ideological politics as national problems have come to the forefront.
We thought pork barrel was bad. Now we've got this. Maybe it was better, but then who could afford it? And it looked awfully inefficient. Nolan McCarty, Ron Fournier, Charles Bass, Congressman Bass, please stand by. Let's go to our listeners. Dory in West Haven, Connecticut. Dory, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I got your voter outrage right here.
Well, let's hear it.
And I want to know when, and I'm talking especially to so-called progressives not necessarily the ones in Congress, but your average, you know, peace lover, which I am.
Okay.
But there's also a part of me that says, how much does it take before we go down there and drag those bozos out of their offices and say enough is enough? Because they've been terrorizing us with the war on terror, and we got to do this and taking away our constitutional rights. I think we should terrorize them a little bit.
Well, there's 500 plus of them. That's a lot of dragging out of office. So how do you think it actually happens, Dory? How do we get out of this?
Well, I'm sure they'll send the black helicopters, but I mean, there's a lot more of us than them. I just want this kind of outrage. I mean, I'm out shopping. Most people don't even know that the government shut down. And most people are so out of touch that they don't even care.
But if everybody starts running down to Washington and pulling people out of offices, we're going to have a real mess here, aren't we?
Let's just scare them a little.
Yeah, okay. Dory, we got it. Message to Congress. Watch out. Dory is up in arms, and she's not alone. James, thank you, Dory. James in Columbia, South Carolina. James, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think the panel is, you know, they're looking at something and they're putting a spin on it, but there's really two things here. We're in a continuing resolution because the Democrats failed to produce a federal budget, and the president is late or fails. For several years they've done this. Republicans have put up a budget. So the reason why we're here is because the Democrats and the president have failed to do their job every year. And that gives the advantage to the Republicans to say, hey, if you want to continue funding the government, you're going to do what we want. And I think the Republicans have taken that one step further and said, listen, the Democrats are pushing us into a socialist state with all their programs, and they don't agree with that, so they're fighting it. So I think that the Democrats are more at fault for the shutdown and the president, because they have failed to do their job, which is to produce a budget.
And left that leverage right there, as it turns out, in the GOP hand. James, I appreciate your call. Ron Fournier, what about James' interpretation?
Well, with due respect, I know where he's coming from. It's true the Republicans in the House have put up a budget. The Democrats would say they've put up a budget, too. Where I would differ with him is that's not their job, just to put up a budget. Their job is to work together, to come together for a budget for all of us that runs our government and doesn't just satisfy the needs of the news cycle and one particular wing of either one of the parties. A budget is something that's supposed to be done together and for the good of the country, and it's not being done. I would just add to what Nolan was saying, that if you go back and look at the last time we're going through this kind of economic change and had a huge income disparity gap and new technologies and mm-hmm. new movements and new social trends were really turning us inside out back at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. We can look back in history and see how we closed that gap up and how new political coalitions formed and how the parties reformed themselves and how the country got its act back together, and out of that came the greatest generation. It's easy now to look at it. It wasn't at the time, and there were some people then who were talking about violence, as we're hearing.
You're talking Teddy Roosevelt and the progressive era, trust busters and all the rest. We'll come back and look at that and much more. Ron Fournier with National Journal. Please stand by. Nolan McCarty out of Princeton. Charles Bass, former congressman out of New Hampshire, maybe looking at going back to Washington to fix this up. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the paralyzing division in Washington, asking what is going on with our democracy, our country, as we're looking at shutdown. People talking about really big, deep problems at the heart of the American system of government. With us this hour, Ron Fournier. He's editorial director of National Journal in Washington, saying we're going from, in his headline, we're going from dysfunction to non-function in the nation's capital. Nolan McCarty is here, professor of political science at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public International Affairs, author of Polarized America. He's done a lot of research on what's driving this polarization. Charles Bass is with us, spent many years in the House of Representatives, representing New Hampshire's 2nd District. His father was a Republican congressman before him. He's watching all this as well. Not crazy about the tactics right now, but says, well, let's look at the issues. Let's bring our listeners straight in. Paul in Somerville, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am wondering, when did ego and hubris of people like Mitch McConnell and John Boehner take superiority over the president's power, office, and status? The issue that I cannot get past is that these, I'll try to find a polite word, these ignoramuses insist that they come higher than the president in our system of government. And that simply isn't true. And I believe, by virtue of the two elections that the president has won, that the American public, yes, sure, there are people who don't support the president, but by and large, they agree with that. The president runs the country, as the Republicans are so fat.
Well, I mean, you know we have a balance of powers. You know Congress has a role here. But let me pick up this issue of the treatment of the president in this case, Charles Bass. If I may, let me bring that to you. You have people, and I've got plenty of comments before me here, saying, look, this is all about they just won't accept Barack Obama. Maybe it's racial, maybe it's ideological, but there's just bone deep resistance to this man that does entail an element of disrespect. But what do you say to that?
Well, first of all, Paul is really incorrect. The Congress has equal status with the president. We know that. Mm-hmm. I think that a culture of president hating, if you will, has arisen in this country since the election of Bill Clinton. And obviously, it was the time when I entered Congress in 1995. And I noted that there were Republicans that just abhorred Bill Clinton, not because of his views on issues, but because of him. And it was a very tumultuous 8 years, or a lot of it was, as we all remember. And then George W. Bush was elected, the same thing, just this horrible venom from Democrats. And now Barack Obama is President Obama, and I see the same thing again. And I guess, Tom, it's a sad commentary on attitudes about individuals. It's not about hating Republicans as people or Democrats as people. It's about disagreeing with their views. And I deplore that that kind of thing. But by the way, a previous caller talked about the budget. This Congress has not done a single appropriations bill. You don't need a budget to do appropriations. And I think it's reflective of the fact that there is tremendous not only issue disparity between the parties, but the political process, I'm moving to that side now, is also prevalent. There are a lot of Democrats who want this shutdown because they want to try to take over the Congress next year. They don't see any other way to do it because things aren't going that badly for the Republicans, but this is the kind of thing that moves it that way. Mitch McConnell doesn't have much latitude because he's got a tough primary in front of him. John Boehner's lost control over two-thirds of his own caucus, so it isn't stable at all the way it is now. And especially on the House side, this issue needs to be worked out. And frankly, the people who are not part of the Republican Study Committee need to stand up to the rest of the conference and stop this process.
John, you're going there with the sort of John McCain wacko bird criticism of some of his fellow party members.
I just think that the situation to shut down government over a 1 year delay on Obamacare is not the issue. The issue is fundamental reform of our tax system, of entitlements, get spending and revenues under control. As the old saying goes, don't fall out with somebody over a dollar, do it over $1 million. As President Obama or others have said, the health care law, whether you like it or not, and I didn't support it, is the law of the land. And as I said earlier, if you want to get to change it, wait until the White House comes to the Congress to make the law work, which it isn't going to work. And then you can make real changes and do it substantively.
All kinds of response from our listener here. Scott looks at what's going on, says empire idiocracy. Peter says the dictatorial monolithic GOP is like Somali pirates. We need the Dems to be Navy SEALs right now. Pete says, I'm sorry, what did the Democrats offer or compromise on? Tim in Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks for calling, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Let me be brief in my comments here, and then I'll let you go here. When are we going to learn, as a people, as a country, that you cannot legislate a man's heart. The basic problem here with these politicians that want to pass all these social reforms and everything else is it's basically a case of forced charity. Okay, we've developed over the years a sense of so much entitlement in this country, and the federal government has never been the best vehicle to implement any kind of charity, whether it's health care, whether it's Social Security, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's food stamps, you name it. The government is way too clumsy and bureaucratic to deal with such things. And one more side note before I go.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. The non-essential 800,000 federal employees that are not working now.
Yeah.
If they're non-essential, why were they working to begin with?
Well, I mean, don't you like national parks? Don't you like NASA to do something good once in a while? I mean, there's a lot that goes on.
I'm just saying if they're non-essential.
You know, I think that you're playing with words. Hey, but listen, decades of private health insurance in this country, and we still had tens of millions without coverage. Doesn't that look like a problem that we as a society ought to care about? After all, we need a good, productive citizenry in this country, don't we, Tim?
That's something that we should care about as a society, but not as a government.
Even if private treatment hasn't worked?
Even if. You know, as far as I know, when the first document said we have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I don't see anything in there about cable TV. I don't see anything in there about health care. I don't see anything in there about all these programs that the government is.
Well, we can make decisions to produce, if we can agree on it, a healthy society. How we do that, whether we do that, wide open at this moment. Tim in Cleveland, I appreciate your call. One more right here, Steve in Berea, Kentucky. Steve, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Okay, what do you see?
Okay, hey, yeah, I just believe that this whole thing is based on power, money, and politics. I don't see it beyond that. I mean, basically, there hasn't been a bigger, something implemented as big as this since FDR and Social Security, and Republicans just can't handle that. I mean, they just can't handle the fact that a Democrat's going to do something big, once again, for the American people, and they just can't handle that fact. I honestly think that, they're afraid of not getting reelected. They're afraid of not being able to get back in office. And that could very well happen if Obamacare is implemented, that it's going to be years, you know, quite a few years before they're back in office.
Steve, we've got it. And I appreciate your call as well. Nolan McCarty, in the past, this country did implement big social programs, as our caller Tim in Cleveland laments, but it sounds as though our caller Steve might be for in this case. What was different then? Why was that possible then? What's made it so fraught now, Nolan?
Well, if you look back at the big periods of innovation in social policy, you have to go back to the New Deal and the Great Society. And for better or worse, those are situations in which one party's control of the government was so overwhelming that they were able to pass things. Those programs were able to establish themselves and take root with fairly minimal organized political opposition. I mean, the Republicans opposed both of those sets of reforms.
Bitterly. Social Security, the Democrats controlled under FDR, but there was bitter Republican opposition to Social Security.
Yeah, but the Republicans didn't gain control of any branch of government until 1948. So they had plenty of time to take root before there was an opportunity to reform it. And by the time that the Republicans were back in position to do something about Social Security, or fast forwarding to the 1970s to do something about Medicare, those programs were very popular, and there were no way that they were going to be reformed out of existence. They could be tinkered with. So I think Steve's point may well be accurate in that there's a concern among Republicans that the same dynamic could happen if the Affordable Care Act were fully implemented and became popular. It would be impossible for the Republicans to reform it, even if they were to retain control of government at some future date.
I mean, is there an issue here? Yes, Ron, please.
Well, if I could just add to that, the New Deal that that no one's talking about. Those programs came out of a similar time like this, when a huge economic transition, as people were moving from an agriculture era to the economic, yep, to the industrial era, and being left behind. That was a safety net that the political system and new coalitions built and defended for the times. I don't know what it is, but that's about what's got to happen now. We have a lot of people who are being left behind, and income disparity is getting bigger and bigger. So we've got to figure out to have a more fluid form of politics that can enact that change and let it solidify, and not constantly fighting the same battle.
But that upheaval that we're in the midst of now has not resolved into that kind of unanimity, or at least overwhelming political one thing or another. Here we are, just stuck on the fence.
You're exactly right. But as Nolan's point is making, it took 3 or 4 decades for all of this to work out, from the beginning of the industrial era to the cementing of the New Deal. We're talking, what, 4 decades, 3 decades, certainly a generation. And we're just at the beginning of a rapid period and a dynamic period of change that I think will be exponentially greater than anything we saw 100 years ago. So I think that's why I think it's Katie bar the door. Anybody who thinks that the way things are happening now are going to stay. I'm betting on change, not status quo. I just don't know what change will be.
I don't know if I can take this. I mean, maybe if some change really begins, maybe that'll be better. Let's go to Tom in Fairley, Vermont. Tom, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to make the point that our politicians are polarized because their bases are polarized. And that is the result of the fact that we have so many news media, so many television stations, radio stations, and especially the Internet, that produce a reality for individuals that, substantiates their views that they already hold. Mm-hmm. And thus, it's a positive feedback loop. As people listen to, a particular talk show point of view, it yep. reinforces their beliefs. And what I see is that Americans are basically sinking into various levels of unreality, because in former days, when we had 3 TV networks, there was a middle of the road, but a lot of vetting of factual information. And America is now beginning to have bubbles of belief that are not based on reality.
And no shared perception to work off of. Charles Bass, how about it, Congressman? All this media, all these different channels, and the web subverting or overwhelming consensual democracy. Do you worry about it?
Well, you had a caller early that commented that the electorate or the population is uneducated. I would suggest that perhaps they hear too much because of this 24/7 micromanagement of the public of what's going on in Washington. And I discovered as a congressman how serious this can be when the whole YouTube process began, and I began to get tracked at every single event I went to. Yeah. I couldn't say anything other than my script, because I knew that everything would be taken out of context, used against me, and so forth. And it's an unfortunate situation which we've got to get behind. Tom, just one other mm-hmm. observation, which I think is deeper than all of this. For the first time in modern history, I think Americans, when asked if they think their children are going to be better off than they are, a majority of them are saying no. And it's this optimism versus fatalism that I think is really deadly here. And what the Democrats are saying is, don't touch my Social Security, don't touch my Medicaid, don't touch my Medicare, give me health care, because in a fatalist view, that's where we wind up. And I think Republicans look at the future and say, look, we got to get out of this rut that we're in with high deficits and all the other problems that we have, and figure out a way to make America a different country than everybody else again.
I mean, I get that you're a Republican and you're flying the flag there, and we get it. On the other hand, we've got to be able to also work together, listen to what the voters want in some significant part.
And I agree with that completely. Well, and that's been my my modus operandi when
Ron,
I was in Congress.
Ron, I hear you there.
Yeah, if I could play the Pollyanna again on the media, and please help me with this, Nolan. If I recall, at the beginning of the when we're still in the heart of the agriculture era, Abe Lincoln, when he decided to run for office, bought a German newspaper, because at the time, all the media was owned by a party. It wasn't until we got into the heart of this period of similar period of change that we're in now, the heart of the Gilded Age, when the muckrakers came up and the new what is now the old media, a vibrant, financially successful, independent, nonpartisan media, actually didn't really take hold until, you know, Ira Turnbull and Upton Sinclair, you know, the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s. So we're kind of going back to a new partisan era in politics and in media. We found our way out of it last time. You couldn't have predicted how, but maybe we can again.
To our listeners' point there, we cannot afford to live in bubbles of unreality. We've all got to do some real testing here, find paths into a real conversation that deals with real problems in this country. I don't know if we've figured it all out, but you've pointed us in some really interesting and, I think, fruitful directions in this hour. Thanks to all three of you, Charles Bass in Peterborough, New Hampshire, former congressman from New Hampshire. Congressman, thanks a lot for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Ron Forney at National Journal. Thank you, Ron, for your time today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Nolan McCarty, we'll have you back. Thank you very much for joining us today, sir.
Great. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for all your comments. Much more online. Check it out. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.